Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Wild Tales Podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by The Book of Man and in partnership with Talisker, the single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Denise Lewis, the iconic British track and field athlete who won Olympic gold at the Sydney Olympics in the heptathlon in 2000. Someone who showed throughout her athletics career the value of resilience, hard work and beating the odds. She's now, of course, a presenter for the BBC and generally one of the best loved faces in the country. In the episode, we answer some questions that you've asked me on Instagram. I'm going to be sending a bottle of Talisker to the top question. In addition, malts.com are offering a 10% off promo code Talisker15DE, redeemable at checkout on www.malts.com until the 30th of November 2020. Discount may only be used once for individual Talisker Distillers edition products. For sale at £100 or less. No minimum spend, but a delivery charge may apply. Not to be used in conjunction with any other offer, and gift card purchases are excluded. 18 plus and subject to malts.com terms of sale. Here we go. Hope you enjoy this episode. Right, here we are with the legend in many different arenas and lots of different careers, Denise Lewis. Thanks for coming on, Denise. How are you?
Hi, Foxy. Listen, it's an honour to be on your show. And listen, the podcasts I heard have been fantastic. They've been brilliant. So I'm really honoured to be on it.
No, not at all. I've been looking forward to this one because, I mean, we've met a couple of times. I sort of didn't play golf with you, but you were in front of me. But I tell people I played golf with you because it's a bit better than saying I was, you know, just in the background, in the periphery.
You had a good game, if I recall.
I'm not good, but yeah, it was one of my better games. Okay, so obviously starting off, we're here to chat everything about Denise Lewis. How's this year been for you? Because it's been odd, hasn't it?
Odd is an understatement. It's just been, at times, you know, the height of lockdown. So, you know, March, April, around that Easter time, I thought, yes, although globally this is a real nightmare, but it's an opportunity for myself, others, and particularly me and my family to spend quality time together. For me, I use it as an opportunity to get fit again, and I loved every minute of it. You know, it was back to the sort of the old days, training twice a day, really getting into some serious like weights and cardio, just ticking off all the boxes in all the areas. And I was just amazed at how fit you can actually get in, you know, 12 weeks, which is something that I used to do on a regular basis. So there was that side of it. But as it's gone on, and here we are, you know, nearly towards the end of the year, I'm struggling not only with the cabin fever mentality, but just living in the brace position of not knowing which way this the whole virus, how life is going to resume again, we ever will see like normality. And so I've just got to keep telling myself that, you know, we will get through this. And whatever's on the other side, human beings adapt. And that's what we'll have to do.
Exactly. I think the way I've looked at this is it has been a massive time of uncertainty. And there's been a lot of people that have suffered in it as well. I appreciate that. Yeah. But this phase we're in is we're just learning about what we need to do going forward, and ultimately we will get through it as humans. We adapt very, you know, quickly. It's just takes a bit of time, and when you're in it, you're like, that Christ, this is taking for ages, but it's what needs to happen, I suppose. And we'll be out the other side, and people, you know, there'll be massive opportunity as well, but people just need to see it in a positive, the opportunity, not the negative that it is. But anyway, that's me banging on enough about that. The So just to explain this podcast, there is a bit of structure to it, believe it or not, but it might not feel like that as we're going through it. But and at the end, what I do is I revisit Instagram because we ask listeners to send in their questions. And I've already had a quick look through this. I don't know why, but you seem to have generated the most funniest of questions.
Oh, my goodness.
In a good way, not in a bad way.
Okay.
So... I might read out a few, but I'll pick one that's the winner because I think there's a few that deserve to be read out. But I need to go and revisit that at the moment. Anyway, first things first, which is an odd phrase, but anyway, we'll use it. First things first, you are about to be on a show called Don't Rock the Boat. I'm looking forward to watching it. It's where, if I'm right in thinking, you rode the length of Britain.
And correct.
I've done a little bit of rowing, but without giving anything away, how was that experience?
Let's just start with a sigh. I knew it was going to be a massive undertaking. You know, as you said, you've rowed before. Open water is very different to, you know, rowing in a lovely boat along the Thames. It was bloody tough. It was tough by my standards. I'd like to think I'm pretty hardy, but yeah. You know, it was just relentless, you know, the sleep deprivation. So we rode through the night. That was tough. Getting used to the different personalities. Everyone sort of came onto the show for different reasons, and you'll know this for SAS. And the competitive Lewis was like, okay, this is about a race to the end. Different stages, let's give it our all. And not everyone was on board with that at times. Right. And so I had to adjust my thinking to make life pleasant. You know, you're sleeping on the boats, everyone's getting tired as the weeks are going on. But for me personally, it was exhilarating and something that I really needed in my life again. You know, after lockdown, to be out in the open air, to see the beautiful English and British coastline as we did, was just stunning. And to really test myself again. You know, I was getting a bit soft around the edges, you know. Life as a mom of four, sometimes you just need a challenge.
Awesome. And I mean, to be fair, I've actually spoken to a couple of other people that were on it and they said almost the same sort of thing as you. I think they've both got very competitive streaks in them. I'm sure you know I'm on about.
I know exactly who you're talking about because your name did come up a few times. But what would Foxy say? What would Foxy do?
Well, I'm laughing. But the truth would probably be a lot different to what I'd, you know, what you reckon I might have said.
But, maybe so.
Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. But I mean, actually, as we speak about this, it's actually, this comes out the day after your first step goes. So just so people are trying to work out why I'm talking in the future tense, it's not the case. It will be in the past tense when you start to watch this. How many episodes is it?
I think it's on all week. So 5 nights
a week long. That's good.
Yeah. There's a lot that we've packed in a lot.
And you've got Freddie presenting, haven't you? And hosting AJ.
And AJ, Adodo. A great combination, those two. What a winning formula, I have to say.
She's
got great energy. I know you've met her. She was on SAS, wasn't she, a couple of years ago?
She did very well, actually. She has got a lot of energy.
Yeah, full of energy.
What was the biggest problems you experienced out on the water?
Keeping people going. just literally, you know what it's like. You know, you think you're in a rhythm and you need a rhythm to keep the boat moving. That's one of the biggest philosophies, is keep the boat moving no matter what you're doing, however you're moving around on the vessel. You just got to keep some sort of, you know, this ton weight going, because once it stops, it's like... It's like, you know, giving yourself a hernia trying to get that thing moving again. And so when you're really tired, the food didn't appeal to everybody. You know, you're trying to, you know, graze, keep your energy going, keep the calories pouring into the muscles, and you're expending a lot because you're on the water for hours. Those were challenging. And I knew that at times, if people didn't eat, we were going to pay the price later on. But the nighttime rows were just hell mentally. In the dark, you could hardly see anything. You know, we had Storm Ellen at one point back then, and it was just like, oh, they're not going to let us die. This is not going to be an interesting show to see. You know, we're lost at sea. Someone, you know, capsized or something. So you just had to keep your head in the right space for a lot of that.
So did you? I don't want to ask too much because I know it's going to continue on, but who were the contestants on it that you wanted to, I've got to be careful how I word this actually. Who were the contestants that you wanted to beat the most? Not beat up, beat.
All right, okay. well, there are two teams, and that's become clear already. There's two teams, and so it was just beating the opposition.
The opposition.
As many times as you possibly can, because you know the show's in stages, and so the legs were obviously had.
Who was on the other team?
I'm not sure I can tell you that.
All right.
Although yeah, they had some pretty competitive people.
It does go out after, so I'm sure the teams would have been announced.
Yeah. Okay. Do I trust you?
You can trust me.
Yeah. Of course I do. Yeah, well, on the other team, you had Victoria Pendleton, who you know is just fiercely competitive. Yeah. Jodie Kidd, again, she should have been, you know, a top flight athlete. She's got the mentality, she's got the staying power, and she, I call her alpha female.
Yeah,
100%. So you can imagine those two together. It was just a nightmare.
I mean,
a nightmare.
I feel sorry for the other people on that team.
Listen, there are a lot of, how can I put this? There was a lot of conversations about how to keep that team harmonious. And you need the harmony. You absolutely need the harmony to get through it.
You do, but you also need the drive in those individuals as well.
Completely. And as you can imagine, Jodie and Victoria had that in spades.
I can imagine. Yes. Right. Moving on, and we're gonna now move in a chronological order, I suppose. So essentially, we're gonna go back to the beginning, and we're gonna start with athletics. And you know, when did you first get into it, and why?
The why is actually really easy. Very easy. I was 8. I watched the Olympics in Moscow, so that was 1980. Daly, Sebco, Ovett, just they call it the golden era of athletics. And I was just summer holidays, so you're sitting there watching, and I was like, wow, that's just phenomenal. And I was already a sporty kid, you know, I loved running at school, up and down the yard at school. I was organising races between the different classes. So, you know, 3B would race against 4J. And, you know, so I was already sort of had that competitiveness in me. And so when I saw that there was somewhere to take that, it was just like fireworks. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to at least be an athlete. I didn't realise the stages, what that entailed. But I wanted to learn how to be better than just running up and down at school. And, you know, I had, you know, as you well know, there is always that person that you meet or people that you meet along the way in your journey that act as those, they're almost pivotal in your decision making. So my very first coach at the club in Wolverhampton and Bilston AC, just made my first experience amazing. You know, I was walking to a stadium that I've never been to before. I'm an only child. My mum took me down 1 year before I was allowed to go because they said I was too young at 8, so I had to wait till I was 9. So on the day we were back there, and that first coach would just made the sessions fun. And he made me want to go back for more and repeat that process and have more fun, learning the disciplines, track etiquette, and patience, and all the skills that you need for life. And yeah. I think had it been an environment that was probably too competitive or too unfriendly, I might never have gone back again. So he was the one that I cite as he pulled at my heartstrings, and I was like, yeah, love this feeling.
Isn't it good how like a less aggressive sort of push into a sport makes you more driven, probably. It makes you hungrier for it because it's become more enjoyable. Because I think there's a lot of things that the enjoyment gets taken out of it at an early age because of the I don't know what it is. It's like that persistent aggressive push, you know, and want for I don't know, to be first, which is obviously a good thing, you know. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but at an early stage in someone's, especially a sporting career, if the child doesn't enjoy it, then they're probably not, they're going to fall out of love with it a lot quicker.
Definitely, I agree with that 100%. I just think we're almost victims of our own progression. The more we know, the more we expect. So, you know, back then it was still a hobby. You know, there's none of this professionalism that's attached to sport these days. And so you're allowed to develop almost organically, naturally, without, you know, that expectation of being the chosen one and driving that ambition through. Almost the coaches want it more than the kids sometimes, or the parents want it more than the kids do. And I think that is a crippling effect for young people, especially when they're not sure how they feel about the sport. They want to do it, but they want to just see and pit themselves and make their own decisions about how successful they want to be and whether they want to be professionals or whether they're just happy being knocking around with their mates or playing county cricket or whatever it might be. Yeah. And I kind of seen that with my son to a degree, because he was at a football academy, just recently released. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I think it might do him the world of good. Yeah. Not because we're particularly pushy parents. It's just that I don't think they made it fun. They didn't make it fun. It just became too much like, you know, judging a young person. And I've seen it with some of his peers, that they're not hungry enough. They're not aggressive enough. When sometimes, you know, you don't always have to be that aggressive, but you've got to be ambitious and hungry. And sometimes those characteristics come later because you learn to be how to nurture that aggression in a different way. How can you judge that at 8, 9, 10 or even 13-year-old kid?
It always seems to be I was never a professional athlete, but I've watched a lot of professional sport and top end sport throughout my life, and it seems now that it's a mad rush to get kids to a certain level, because athletes nowadays are so much younger than they were when I was a kid. When I used to watch, they seem a lot younger. I think they seem, I don't know, it's a mad rush to get teenagers to be to actually compete at a pro level. And I think that's that mad rush can be a bit of a shame sometimes, and it probably destroys some people's love for something that they did actually genuinely love in the first place. It's sort of, it's mental how that seems to have unfolded. I might be wrong, but I genuinely think that it just seems to be a mad rush.
I think you're right. I just, one sport that does spring to mind, and, we see in gymnastics, and that's a whole other story, but with rugby in particular, you know, how many of these sort of 14, 15-year-old boys look like men, because they're probably training way too hard, because the aspiration is to get to a really top club, maybe play for England one day, and they're eating all the proteins, they're taking the shakes, they're doing all of that stuff when they're still developing and still learning, and they're getting too big probably too soon. I just think there is time as a place, and I can say that wholeheartedly because I'm a product of that patience. Yeah. I'm a product of that patience, learning your trade, feeling your way through it, and making the right choices along the way, and having patient people around me, actually.
Yeah, it's weird because I was out in Australia earlier this year, and I had to do the quarantine, and I got in the quarantine. I had 2 weeks of basically watching the NRL, and I proper love it. It's a hardcore environment, but they've been chatting on the thing over there about this. I think he's like 15, 16 year old kid that's playing in the schools, but he's wiping the floor with all the other opposition school teams out there. He's this one man band that can literally, because he's quite powerful and dominant, and they're actually considering signing him up to an NRL team. And it is, I can't believe that they're actually considering it. I think they need to let him, because if that happens, he's going into one of the hardest hitting sports on the planet at the moment. And I think it will destroy him as an individual, maybe not a player, but I don't know. Yeah, I could be wrong, but it's an interesting conversation.
I just think sometimes mentally, you're not as far ahead in the game as you possibly are physically. I.e., this 16-year-old has the body probably of a 23-year-old man, but mentally, he isn't ready to join the big boys.
No,
absolutely isn't.
Because he hasn't had any hard hits anyway.
No.
Okay. Anyway, we're detracting. We're supposed to be talking about you. So going back to you as a young athlete, and you know, you're learning your trade, I suppose, aren't you? Were you a natural talent, or were you more along the lines of putting in a lot of hard work?
No, definitely not the latter. I was a talented child, but I think, like we just spoke about, each stage, you're always going to come up with somebody who's better than you.
Yeah.
It's quicker than you, can jump higher than you. And that was my experience at town level, district level, county level, and early international, junior international level. There were people that were just like, okay. So I thought I was good, but I'm actually just okay. And some people were just still so far ahead of me. But it didn't deter me. It just didn't. I just thought, okay, I'd need to improve.
Yeah.
How do I just get better? And whether that's physically, or is that how to deal with not being the best or not running as fast? It was always trying to find a solution to that. And by the time I became a junior international, I still was very much passionate about being in athletics because I was still having fun.
Yeah, yeah.
I was still having fun. So fast forward to the Commonwealth Games of 1994, which I was 20. I was sort of under the radar. No one really expected me to come through and win a medal of any description, let alone win it. Yeah. And that was sort of a turning point for me mentally, that even with all, I'd say, the limitations or the things I didn't know about myself, because I had no... understanding of what it takes to win, really.
Mm.
I'd just been thrust into this position by a really solid 2 days performance and one, as someone would say, lucky javelin throw that made me, you know, just accelerate up the leaderboard and win. There was still a lot to learn.
It was
in the headline. It was the headlines. I literally beat the favourite, the reigning Commonwealth champion, Jane Fleming, who literally, for her, it was just, she was going to rock up, retain her title. There was no one on paper that
duty
looked like they could challenge
duty
her.
Duty 10 for her. Duty of 10. You all got it in the bag type thing.
Yeah. And so this little girl from Wolverhampton rocks up and, you know, made a competition of it and ultimately won. And so I didn't know what that felt like. And so I had to learn a lot about what it takes to win. And that's when I sort of turned everything inwards and started thinking about my nutrition. There was going to be no more trips to, you know, get no Colonel Burgers for me anymore. You know, you go through that teenage phase where, you know, you just want all the grub, because I wasn't allowed to have it at home. My mom, you know, we didn't have much, but she always cooked really good food.
I haven't left the phase. Still in it.
Oh, folks, you don't make me laugh, but you know, that junk food craving, I just thought, you know what, you know, I mean, we need to start getting serious now.
That's a great story, and I didn't even really know about that, to be honest with you, because I was I know all about your history, but I don't know the intricate stories of some of it. I've got to ask you, what did you initially go in and think, right, I'm going to do heptathlon because I like doing all of the events? Or was it that you sort of, how do you become like a heptathlete? Because it is quite, it's the gnarliest of disciplines. In fact, it's not, it's the gnarliest. For me, track and field is about, you know, the heptathlon or the decathlon, whatever you want to call it, because it's a super exciting way to watch athletics, and the leaderboard changes, and each person's got their own strengths and weaknesses, and they play it out and all this sort of thing. But how do you choose to become a heptathlete?
It's funny, because I think a lot of athletes don't tend to choose to be heptathletes. Some do, but not many. You usually start off with the single events, which almost is counterproductive to learning which events suit you. You know, I think every child should come into an athletics club and try everything. And some people come in, I want to be a sprinter, because, you know, let's say when Usain Bolt was around, everyone wanted to sprint. You know, maybe back in the day when Carl Lewis, everyone wanted to long jump. But for me, I was a really strong and true club athlete. So, you know, people used to drop out all the time. So that Saturday competition, you know, there'd be gaps. So, oh, Denise, will you just throw a shot put for us? Yeah, no problem. Oh, will you do the hurdles? Yeah, not a problem. But I did love hurdles and long jumping. Those were my two events that I did from sort of the get-go in athletics. And I would say I'm a product of good discipline at my very first track. I tried a bit of everything. And so I was capable. And my coach, in my teens phase, he was very much, oh, why don't you try heptathlon? Why don't you give it a go? And I was like, yeah, maybe. I'd watched Daly as a child. I knew about Mary Peters. And I think having a local heptathlete that was also a Commonwealth champion, she'd been to the Olympics and she competed at World Championships on my doorstep. Yeah. You know, I would converse with her, you know, a couple of times a week at the local track. And I think seeing her, I got more confident that, you know, maybe I could do heptathlon. You know, I didn't train with her, but she was always there for advice.
Yeah.
And I took part in one competition. I absolutely loved it. I loved the camaraderie, the chatting, the testing yourself. Hated the 800, mind you, but I still enjoyed that physical challenge.
Yeah.
And I didn't look back. That's my story to heptathlon.
Hated the 800. That's because it's nearly a kilometer of sprinting.
Exactly.
Horrendous.
Even though if you saw me run, it never ever looked like a sprint. Trust me.
You take aside from your wins and all the great things that go with your career, do you take pride in knowing that you were a heptathlete? Because ultimately, as a kid, when you think about the Olympiad and everything, it was about that, wasn't it? It was about being a master of a lot of disciplines and who could jump the furthest, the highest, who could run the quickest. There must be a lot of pride to be in the arena as a heptathlete, you know, with all your other, your opponents and that.
Definitely. You feel like you're part of the original, the origins of the event and the whole Olympic spirit, you know, higher, faster, stronger, you know. It's just, there's something magical about combined events. There really is. Even now when I'm watching, you know, the guys compete, whether it's in the heptathlon or the decathlon, there is a sense of unity, which is quite refreshing in an individual sport. You see that the crowd enjoy that journey of the athletes through the 2 days of competition, the highs and lows. It's literally like a drama unfolding each time. And I just think the mental game, and we know there's mental game and there's a mental application that you have in all sports, but, you know, you'd never really truly switch off over those 2 days, because if you're not visualizing what to do in your downtime, then what you're doing, you know, you're constantly living, feeling the events, thinking about what's coming up next. You understand the point scores, but you just try not to immerse yourself in that too much. You let the coaches deal with that. but it's really taxing. It's taxing on the mind.
Mm. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's amazing to watch. That's about as far as I know. That's about as far as my knowledge goes on it. I don't know about taking part in it,
but you know about the mental application and what you've got to have when things aren't going really well, right?
Yeah.
You've got to see in the heptathlon, and you know that the next event you have to turn it on. You've got to turn it on. So you have to hone in specifically on the one part of that skill that makes you better, and that's going to give you a likely outcome for success.
Yeah, I like the way you talk about the visualization, where even in your downtime, and it was the same. I'd like to suggest it was the same as a professional soldier. You're there with a group of guys, and even before you do anything, you're just getting yourself in the zone, and you're trying to think about every eventuality that could happen and what you'd do if it went that way or this way. And yeah, there's if you're going to be good at something, you've got to get yourself into visualizing what's going on and how it feels. 100%
completely.
First serious competition, and when did you start winning? How long after your first did you win your first serious competition?
First serious competition, Christ. They all feel serious when you're learning, you know, but if you're talking about internationals, big international competition, right, Foxy? Because I would say that would be that Commonwealth Games that I talked about in 94. Yeah. That was a big deal for me. It was big for my club. It was big for the region because I'm a Midlander. Yeah. And it was, you know, I started to enter the international domain, you know.
Yeah.
I was no longer just in my small pond anymore. I've just got a foot and a toe in the big league, you know, because
yeah.
Now every time I was introduced after winning the Commonwealth Games, I was introduced as Denise.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Lewis, Commonwealth champion. And it's like, you know, you hear that and you kind of like, they're talking about me. That's me, that is. And so you've got to get used to wearing that jacket, you know, and that coat, and making it feel comfortable. And that takes a while.
But then it's what spurs you on to push yourself again, isn't it? To take yourself out of your comfort zone again, and, you know, make the Commonwealth champion, make that title something else, you wear something else. So with that in mind, let's go back to the Olympic gold, because you were carrying injuries, weren't you?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, it was just.
What was that like? What was that Olympics like?
Those were, in my mind, they were supposed to be my Olympics. You know, even before entering the arena, all that's in that Olympic cycle, that 4 year that Olympiad from 96 to 2000, it was always okay. I've done one. Yes, not that feels like, got a medal, but I want the big G. And so I always thought that 4 more years, I'll be ready.
Mm.
And so to be injured, having set a new Commonwealth record, I was ranked number one in the world. And then like 10 weeks before the start of the championships, to be injured, Achilles tendon, an injury that I hadn't had before, just it floored me.
Yeah.
Because I just thought, why? I'd made so many decisions and right choices. I moved to Holland. I worked with a Dutch coach. There was a lot of things that I did all in the name of performance and getting better and to give myself a fighting chance in Sydney. So to be, to have that stumbling block, I was devastated, absolutely devastated. And that, again, I had to rely on my team to build me up, not only physically, but mentally, but also my coach at the time, Charles Van Comine, was amazing because he sat down with myself and my doctor and said to me, look, Denise, there is a small outside chance that you could be ready in time for the games, but it's a very slim one.
Yeah.
But if you say you're going to go for it, we'll do everything we can to make sure we give you a fighting chance, but the decision is yours. And so my coach was very much of the opinion that if you commit yourself to the process, I don't want you whining and complaining, you know, about woe is me. You're going to focus on your other leg, your mental approach, your arms. We can still train around the injured part, but I need you to be committed. I can't have you living in the why me. That was another game changer for me because it allowed me to stop thinking about the medal and about the outcome of possibly winning the championships. It was very much of what can you do today? What part of your training can you focus on and taking those tentative steps to recovery?
You removed that sort of victim mindset, I suppose, and got you the positive sort of fighter's mindset, I reckon.
Correct.
Yeah. What was it like? You know, obviously, he's prepared you psychologically, I'd say, but you've still got that niggling in the back of your head going into that Olympics. What was it like when you actually stepped out onto the track and field, into the stadium, and you started to compete? How did it go? Talk us through the table, you know, with all the other opponents that you've got against you there. What was the emotional roller coaster like?
Well, talk about trust is a big thing, and I trusted my team. You know, I had an excellent physio, just first class, you know, really, really knew his stuff. And he said, I used to have to take my ankle every time I moved. So from my knee down to my midfoot was taped. Yeah. And I'd had to do that every single day for those 9 weeks and during the championships. And so it was almost precision, methodical routine. And when I walked into the arena, I had to trust my leg. I didn't want to think about it. I only wanted to be a competitor and think about the performance end of it. But you can imagine when the gun went for that first 100 meter hurdles, which is the first event of the 2 days, my heart was racing. You know, you had all the Union Jacks flying. Everybody sort of knew that I was injured because they could see the taping, but they were behind me. And I crossed the line. I ran an all right time, but in relation to my biggest competitor, I was still in the mix. And that was a massive relief. And so once those sort of handbrake was off, I was fully into the competition. There was no thinking about the injury until I did pick up a second injury later on in the competition. But at the time, at the beginning of the competition, I was raring to go.
What was the second?
So day two, start of the long jump. I completed one jump. And at the start of the second round, I had this ridiculous pain in the opposite foot. So my left leg had been taped. That was the problematic one. But my right foot had just decided to pack up at that stage as well. And I was just thinking, for the love of God, what is going on? Is there some other force at play here saying that you shouldn't be here? Why are you here? So I took my second jump and looked at my physio. I'm like, you know, my foot's hurting. You know, shaking. Everyone's kind of going, what's going on? So I went back into the sort of the recovery room, physio room, and everyone was like, what's going on? I said, I don't know. I just can't put the weight down on my foot. It's killing me. And so there's this mad scramble of like trying to work out what we had to do. Try not to panic. You go on ice, you do all the things that you're supposed to do. I had a big gap because there usually is a big gap between the first event of the second day and the penultimate event, which is javelin, one of my strengths. And so I had time to figure it out. But as the javelin, the time sort of started ticking on, the hours were going, the pain wasn't really subsiding. So it was just one of those championships where you just couldn't write it. At the time, we were thinking, how is this even happening? And eventually, my doctor said, I can give you like a pain-killing injection, but I still had the 800 meter to run. So I didn't want to do that either. And he understood that. And he said, okay. My coach then took charge because he's like, I'm the overarching person here. So no injection. Let's try and tape it and offset the pain. And let's, the chips almost fall where they fall. You know, we've got this far. Let's just see what happens. Had a great javelin. I don't know how, but in my mind, I just was like, you've got this far. You've walked this journey for this moment in your life. You know, why? Just don't lose it now. You'll never get another opportunity like this. And that was the sort of the calling, the thing that was keeping me going.
Yeah, yeah. So you get to the end. You've got, how did it feel knowing that you'd won the gold? What's that feeling like?
There's relief. As you can imagine with the injury, there was relief. There was like this crazy kaleidoscope of emotions of, you know, you see yourself as a child, you know, almost like a flashback of your life. You know, you see the people that have helped you. You hear the, you know, the crowd behind you. You know, I could see my mom and she was bawling her eyes out. My coach was standing there with a sense of pride in his face. My team managers, my girlfriends, my team members were there screaming, whooping. It was just overwhelming. It was overwhelming, but I was a long way from home, you know, in Sydney. And that emotion then just kept carrying on. When I got back to the UK, it was just another sort of tsunami of emotions and realizing how much one performance could affect other people in such a positive way.
Even though it was like tough and an emotional roller coaster, you know, with everything, with the injuries especially as well, do you still, when it was over, did you look back on it and like, did you miss it? Did you miss being in that moment, or were you glad it was over and that you've got the gold and done and dusted?
I think there's two things. I think you miss, and if you're talking about retirement or just that moment, I mean,
not just that moment to begin with.
Just that moment. Okay. So just that moment, you just relive it. And it's not whether that you intentionally are trying to, but it is such a life-changing experience, you know, to stand on the podium and hear the national anthem. It just never sounds the same in your ears, you know. It's just so uplifting that it's really talking to your core. And that I have that, you know.
Did you get emotional?
Inside I was emotional, but I was, at the time I was overwhelmed, and so I just didn't know what to think or feel. It was just, my whole body was just tingling. I didn't sleep a wink that night. I had the medal on my pillow next to me. I couldn't celebrate really because I was in a house with other competitors, and some of which were still competing. And so, you know, by the time you get back to the village, it's like 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning. Crazy times. Next morning, you've got like a schedule, you know, a media train that you have to address. And so you don't actually have much time to digest what's happening. You're retelling the story, you're retelling the emotions, and it's almost like autonomous. You know, you just don't quite register that it's happening to you.
Yeah. It's like you're on a conveyor belt of...
Yeah.
You're going over the same thing, isn't it? Over and over again. Yeah. Different journey. How did you handle the limelight at the time? Whether it was out there and also coming back to the UK, because obviously it was a big thing to come back, wasn't it, with a gold medal?
Yeah. I just don't think it's limelight in, as when you're part of a greater team. So Team GB, you just feel like you've represented your people and, you know, and how much aspiration and inspiration that gives to your other competitors, you know, within all the different sports, because we all try and keep a tap on who's doing what, who's on that day. And so there is a real team feeling. And so it's not limelight. It's like I came out here to do a job. I've done my job, and you know, yeah, we're all in this together. You know, someone else's failure can feel like a celebration, even if it's not that person. You know, so there's that unity, which is very, very special. But the greater public, it was kind of weird. It was weird because, you know, in my head, I'm still the same person, but now you're sort of elevated to a different, I don't know, just a different life, you know. I'm not saying it's rock and roll, but it was, you know, you're invited to nice places, you know. Went to Buck House a couple of times, you know, Buckingham Palace, had a nice meal with the Queen, you know. You get to do nice things, which is really special. And all the moment, you're just pinching yourself. You know, I could go to the grocery store and people stop you. They want to do all of that. But after a while, it does feel quite intrusive, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because ultimately, you know, I'm quite a, you know, down-to-earth person. And, you know, people don't understand that when you lose your anonymity, it takes some getting used to. You know, you could just rock up and go places. You know, that's it's hard to deal with, especially when you're still... you know, in your early, you know, I was 29.
Yeah, yeah.
28 to 29, still dealing with all of that. Still quite early in your life. But, you know, fast forward a good few years, you just normalize and just realize that people are just really proud of you. And so you try, they enjoying that moment with you.
Well, I mean, yeah, gold medal winner is just unbelievable. But what do you think was your, what was your drive? What kept you going at the top levels? You know, how did you maintain that? Because it is, I mean, I've got no idea when it comes to Olympic training camps, but you've got to dig deep, haven't you, sometimes? Because it's relentless, especially when you're trying to be the best at seven different disciplines. What was your drive? What kept you going?
I think it's that just self improvement. You know, they say success makes you more hungry almost. You know, you just want to keep that in that bubble because your expectations are now high. You know, fourth place, fifth place, it's just not acceptable. It doesn't feel comfortable anymore once you've won.
Yeah.
And you know, when that eventually started to happen, you know, my body breaking down post sort of 2004, so the Athens Olympics, things didn't go well for me at all. You know, it just is like, I don't like this. I'm not in control anymore of how often I can train, how long I can train, and the amount of pain I'm in. I'm spending more time on the physio bed than I am sort of training. Then it's not fun anymore. But at the time when you're in that sweet spot, if you'd like, for want of a better expression, of success and training, it's that need to tap into the potential that you believe is still there, you know, and that's what keeps you going. Me jumping 650 or 660, I feel I can jump 670, so let me try and invest that energy into that. You know, we're talking about marginal gains here, you know, 10 centimeters. You know, you train all year round pretty much for 10 centimeters in one event, that is, obviously.
It's mad when you think about that. Obviously, people at home are like, oh, they're just training to be the best. And you're like, to be the best actually involves just like...
it's that, yeah. It's 10 centimeters. It's half a second. Yeah. You know, it could be it's 2 meters. It's crazy.
When you think of it like that. So you've spoken about 94, the Commonwealth Games. You've spoken about the 2000 Olympics in Sydney. What are there any other career highlights? I mean, they're obviously, that's like the beginning and then that's the pinnacle. But are there any others?
In terms of competition, I think you know, retaining my, I guess, yeah. I mean, there's sort of, there was always something to be pleased about, to rejoice or celebrate. You know, although I finished second in one of the world championships, I actually threw the most incredible shot put. You know, you look at my form and my physique and you think, you wouldn't put the distance with my body, put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, so to achieve that is really a golden nugget.
Yeah.
I didn't win, but on the day I actually performed at my very best, you know, with all the issues that I had beforehand, you know, few injuries in the middle of the season, which I think just cost me, you know, on competition day, but that's sport, you know.
Yeah,
but that shot put for me, I'll look back with very, very fond memories of just beasting it and feeling like I was a shot putter for the day.
You were. Okay, we'll go forward again to the, obviously you spoke about 2004, the Athens Olympics, and, you know, we don't need to talk about that too much, but what it does lead me on to ask you, what it leads me on to talk to you about is, how did you begin to wrestle with the idea of retiring, and how was that mentally?
Oh, hell. Yeah. Absolute hell. You know, being an athlete, being a sports person is a lifestyle. You know, it's everything. It encompasses just absolutely everything. It defines you, or you believe it defines you and who you are, what you represent. You know, you don't have to tell people what you do. You know, you get these financial advisors, you know, it's like, actually, what do you do? No, I'm a sportswoman. You know what I do. It's, you know, it's everything. And so having to deal with retiring and the realization that I was not at the level that I wanted to compete at was just tough. It was tough. And I just think at the time, I didn't feel like I had enough support mentally, physically. I didn't feel that I had a place to go to talk about my feelings. It sounds kind of crazy to say that when it's an individual sport, people would assume that you just make the decisions, and it doesn't kind of work like that, because these are, you know, affairs of the heart, you know, and sometimes when you are in a bit of a downward spiral, you don't have that objectivity that someone else may have. And I think looking back with hindsight, I needed that. You know, I might have segued into another sport, which, you know, a few athletes do now. But those conversations weren't had. So I kind of slipped away quietly. There was no fuss, no fanfare, nothing. I just was like, okay, it's time. Bye-bye.
How did you deal with that? Do you think you dealt with it quite well?
I know I dealt with it better than some.
Yeah.
And maybe because I had achieved the ultimate, perhaps made me deal with it more, maybe a bit better than some. And also a family. I was starting a family as well. So there were things that I could say could distract me from the pain of retirement, but there were some dark, not to say dark moments, but some very quiet moments where there was some soul searching. You know, you go to fill in that occupation box on forms and you kind of like, well, I'm not a sportswoman anymore. Who am I? What am I? What am I going to do with myself?
I think,
you know, it's hard.
Yeah. But I think obviously you went from one purpose to the other, like this, the family thing, that's a purpose. So maybe that lessened the blow. What would you put down now if you had to write occupation, by the way?
Don't know. Just, yeah. Still don't know. Still working it out.
You're a presenter.
I do, what is it? Not applicable.
You are a presenter, no, aren't you?
Yeah,
you enjoy
I do.
That.
I do. I am and I do. I have to say that London 2012, although I wasn't competing, did save me and did give me a lot to look forward to, because I was part of the presentation team that went out to Singapore, and we actually won the bid there. So I had to speak and do a little speech out there. It gave me purpose. It gave me a feeling that I was doing something meaningful again. So that was 2005.
I remember it. I remember I was in a military base somewhere eating lunch. I can remember the moment when they said, oh yeah, London has won the 2012 Olympics. That was a massive achievement when you think about it.
Huge. So to answer one of your other questions is, what was the other career highlights? For me, that was hands down one of them. Although it was me individually, I felt part of a team, which I was, the presentation team, but also that feeling that Britain were going to get something that they have never really kind of got before, you know, in the new era of modern sports, that the Olympics were going to come to London and just be awesome. And they absolutely were. They delivered on so many counts.
It was an exciting time, that, in 2005. And then it was, you know, it came to life in 2012. And I mean, it must have been awesome to be a part of that as well. Like you said, not competing, but there was a massive buzz, wasn't there? And I remember coming up to London, and I lived away at the time, and you know, there was a big sense of pride for people, and it was like there was a massive buzz about it, wasn't there? It was all glad that I experienced it.
Yeah, it's just, even now talking about it, I get tingles, you know, down my spine. It's just, it was so, as you said, it was a national pride. It was just that moment of seeing people enjoying and embracing Britishness in all its glory and all its colours and unity, coupled with fantastic performances. You know, it was just great. And then we had the Paras as well, Paralympics, which was just like a game changer for the Paralympic movement. You know, it was just set a new bar of expectation and engagement, which was phenomenal to watch as well.
Yeah, it was brilliant. Do you reckon you need a certain mindset to be a good presenter, especially in when you present sports or athletics?
We're live, you know, so you've got to be that readiness that you talk about. You know, we're almost kind of limbering up, waiting in the wings to go on and perform. You know, with hopefully the interface between, you know, the action, what's going on behind the scenes, which there is a lot going on behind the scenes. Anyone who works in television will see that it's the duck on the water. Everything looks like it's going seamlessly on top, and then behind, underwater, the legs are going, ah, going crazy.
You should make a TV show of that. Just
oh, they should. Oh, chaos. And so, yeah, there is a certain mindset. You've got to be adaptable. You've got to, you know, again, realize that you're part of a team, because there are things going on which some person will rely on you. And my role as a pundit, and especially when you're live, you're not studio, you're, you know, outside broadcast, you know, things happen. And your team has to trust that you can actually fill the time. No one wants, you know, dead space on television. You know, you've got to keep that turning. And you know, when you've got a good team around you, it's almost effortless.
Yeah. It's good to watch. I do enjoy it. We're coming close to readers' or listeners' questions, should I say.
Yeah.
But before we get to those, I want to just ask you what's coming up? What's next for yourself?
Well, I've got an exciting project coming up, but I can't tell you much about it. We have to wait and see. I know, how boring. I know, I'm sorry. But, you know, I just want secrecy. But I'm in a good spot. I mean, I'm in a good spot, put it that way. I've been doing new things, as you said. You know, you will have watched, hopefully, the first step of Don't Rock the Boat, which was just phenomenal. And also, you think in the next year, we've got the Olympics again. So it's, you know, you're going to blink, it's Christmas, it's Easter, and, you know, it'll be all roads, hopefully, fingers crossed, will point to Tokyo.
You're going to be quite busy then next year, really, aren't you, with all that in mind?
Well, next year.
This show that's going out, obviously, now, Don't Rock the Boat, which is, what time's it going out?
9 p.m. ITV1.
9 p.m. ITV1, Don't Rock the Boat. And then, obviously, you know, Tokyo next year. It's going to be exciting, yes. Hopefully.
And, you know, not that I'm in long-term strategy mode here, but, you know, 2022, we've got the Commonwealth Games in Birmingham. So my patch is going to come alive with Commonwealth action. I just can't wait. And so Birmingham has taken on a massive facelift. It's undergoing a facelift right now, and it has even over the last sort of 15 years. You know, it's unrecognizable from the place that I used my old stomping ground as a kid. But yeah, 2022 Commonwealth Games is going to be great. And then Team England's competing. We hope to do really, really well on home soil, utilize that home advantage. Naturally, the Australians will be coming over looking to dominate, but hopefully our athletes will be ready and the country will be ready by then with hopefully recovery. It'll be give people something to look forward to on home soil again, which would be really nice.
Cool. Right. We're going to go on to these Instagram questions. There's a few that I'll read out in first that they're not winners, I'd like to point out. One of them is by Victor Sacchifio. He's won it before anyway, so he can't win again. But I want to read out his question. Are you ever just too lazy to get out of bed and then think, I'm an OBE now, so I can just lay in?
I love it. I crave those days, those lying days.
You've got a youngster, haven't you?
I have. I've got a two-year-old. He'll be two next month. And I'm just like, what are those days when you could just lie in and watch Dross TV till sort of 11 o'clock in the morning? You know, those things don't happen anymore. They don't. So forget the OBE. My children just won't let me do that. They're too demanding.
They don't care about the OBE.
They're not interested. Not interested.
Right. So here we go. The winning one. Now, this isn't, I'm not being biased here. I'm just asking what I think is a slightly more sensible question. Not that the others weren't sensible, but you know what I mean.
Get yourself in trouble now.
By someone called Sophia Fox 6. Says, hi, Foxy. Denise, what is your favourite heptathlon event? If you could go for a run anywhere in the world, where would it be? And finally, weirdly, what's your favourite cheese?
I'll go with the last one first. I love a bit of Gruyere.
All right, yeah.
Cheese. Nice. Yeah, nice bit of stinky cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a good one. Good. Where would I run if I could run anywhere? Well, funny enough, I haven't been to New Zealand.
Oh.
I have never been to New Zealand. So I'm sure I'd love to run there because everyone tells me it's an amazing place. What was that?
South Island. The South Island. Yeah. Monica. That's pretty
special. So that's where I should be running, right?
Yeah, I reckon you'd probably like it there if you're going to run anywhere.
Is it flat? Is it flat? Not really.
There's bits of it, yeah, but it's predominantly known for its mountains. So.
Okay, no, then that's not me. That's definitely not me.
Around Wanaka Lake, that's flat because it's around a lake.
Yeah, that's fine. And it's sunny.
Normally.
Yeah, that'll do.
Okay. And then ultimately, your favourite heptathlon event?
I'd say javelin because it bailed me out of so much shite.
with your lucky javelin throw.
My freaky, lucky javelin throws. They've won me medals, put it that way. So good. I have to pay homage to the javelin.
The javelin. All right. Awesome. Well, anyway, that draws our podcast, this podcast, to a close. Denise, I really want to thank you for coming on. It's been really enjoyable, and I've enjoyed listening to your emotional ups and downs going through, you know, starting athletics, winning gold, winning the Commonwealth Games, and then going on to be and winning the 2012 Olympics as well to come to London, and also going on to be a great presenter. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you, mate. See you soon.
Yeah, likewise. See you in a bit. There we are. Big thanks to Denise, and I really hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisca for supporting this podcast, and thanks to you all out there for listening. See you again soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.